Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotin in Washington, D.C.
All these cities and villages they conquered right up to Goma and now Bukavu. Perhaps they are targeting Uvira. Well, it went like a knife in the butter.
Anxiety is rising in the DRC capital, Kinshasa, following the advance of the M23 rebels in the eastern part of the country.
I think what Rwanda is trying, the message is trying to convert Belgium, as is clearly stated in the communique, is that they don't want to be bullied and they don't want to be diverted from what they think are necessary actions to get rid of this cyclical, what they call ethnic extremism in the region.
Rwanda suspends diplomatic cooperation with Belgium.
It's a step in the right direction, because if you look at most of the challenges that we have faced as a republic, had to do with the issue of corruption and how to fight corruption.
And Ghanaian President John Dramani Mahama calls on all his appointees to declare their assets. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, an academic says anxiety is rising in the capital, Kinshasa, following the advance of the M23 rebels in the eastern part of the country. Professor Antoine Lukongo, a lecturer at the University of Kinshasa, says top military leaders of the DRC army have failed to protect the country's territorial integrity. It follows local media reports of fear that the rapid advance of the M23 rebels since their seizure of territories could pave the way for them to march toward Kinshasa with little resistance from the National Army. Professor Lukongo tells me that fears the rebels could march toward Kinshasa appears to be an accurate reflection of the situation on the ground.
Well, from Bunagana, and they went through Ruchuru, all these cities and villages they conquered, right up to Goma and now Bukavu. Perhaps they are targeting Uvira. Well, it went like a knife in the butter. The strategy of our army was always withdraw in order to regroup and do better. But unfortunately, it was always the M23 who were making gains. And if people fear that they might arrive soon to Kinshasa, I can understand this argument, because Bukavu is kind of a carrefour. From Bukavu, they can go to Katanga or to Maniema and up to Kisangani, even to Kasai, which is just close to Bukavu. So I can understand that argument.
But Professor Lukongo, the question people are asking is, why are members of the DRC army unable to stop the advance of the M23 rebel group?
That's a very good question. The problem actually is the weakness of the Congolese army because of the corruption. The Congolese army in the front line are not being armed well, supplied well, and if they are attacked, they don't send them the renfort quickly from Kinshasa or from Kisangani. And so they find themselves in front of the dilemma. If we fight now, we don't have enough resources. Actually, the resources that are being planned by the government are being, in terms of money, millions of dollars are being embezzled right in Kinshasa. So there are no effect there at the front line. I can tell you that I live in Kinshasa and I see the big houses that our generals are building in Kinshasa. And so you wonder, where does the money come from?
So the question, Professor Lukongo, is how can this be resolved? What do you think can happen to end the conflict now?
The way out now is what? The way out is inter-Rwandan dialogue. So Hutu and Tutsi should forgive each other. In Congo, the international community put pressure on us to organize the inter-Congolese dialogue. Peace in Eastern Congo passes through inter-Rwandan dialogue, because if there is social and political stability in Rwanda, then automatically there will be peace in Eastern Congo. When all the Hutus who are in Congo, in Tanzania, in Kenya, and all over the world, they are accepted to come back, and there's a dialogue with the Tutsi, and they all become political, economic stakeholders in one country, Hutu, Tua, and the Tutsi living together in harmony. But that's the solution the international community, America, European Union, they are avoiding. But that's the key solution. Secondly, from our side, we need to reorganize the state. The state is very weak in Congo. We always have very strict elections. Our leaders they have a bad conception of power, and that's a reality in Congo. We need to change the concept we have about the power, about the politics, and the legacy of Mobutu is still alive in Congo. And so our neighboring country are somehow also exploiting our weaknesses. That's the reality. That is the very reality.
Antoine Lukongo is a lecturer at the University of Kinshasa. He spoke with me from the Congolese capital, Kinshasa. In Rwanda, the government has announced the suspension of its diplomatic cooperation with Belgium. This after accusing the European country of trying to prevent Rwanda from accessing international funding and lobbying for sanctions to be imposed on the administration in Kigali over the country's alleged role in the ongoing conflict in the Eastern DRC. It comes as Rwanda alleged that Belgium has teamed up with the DRC to push to restrict Kigali's access to development finance from multilateral institutions to put pressure on the country. The government in Kinshasa, the United Nations, the United States, and other government accused Rwanda of supporting the M23 rebel group. The Rwanda government denies actively backing the rebels, but says its troops have acted to protect its borders and sovereignty. Rwanda also accuses the DRC of sheltering a militant group that aims to oust the Kigali government. For analysis and the latest development, I reach Goloba Mutebi. He is a political analyst based in the Rwandan capital, Kigali.
I did not expect it to happen, but it doesn't surprise me that it has happened, because I have been hearing over the last 3 weeks or 4 weeks that Belgium was very busy mobilizing European countries or European governments to carry out punitive actions against Rwanda for its alleged actions in the DRC. I have heard this from fairly reliable sources that even as other governments were not quite sure how to react, Belgium was very busy trying to influence their decisions. And I think that what they were driving at was to cut aid to Rwanda, suspend development cooperation, and impose sanctions and things of that kind. Now, this is not the first time Rwanda reacts to these kinds of things in the way it has reacted. Let's remember that in 2006, in reaction to similar behavior by France at the UN and within multilateral development agencies, Rwanda severed diplomatic ties with France.
Well, I was about to ask you that there are fears that this could escalate where Rwanda can decide to sever ties with Belgium. Your take?
Well, whatever happens after this will really depend on how Belgium reacts and how Belgium chooses to escalate or de-escalate the tensions. If Rwanda had wanted to sever diplomatic ties, I think they would have gone on and done that directly rather than simply suspending development aid. I think what Rwanda is trying, the message is trying to convey to Belgium, as is clearly stated in the communique, is that they don't want to be bullied and they don't want to be diverted from what they think are necessary actions to get rid of this cyclical, what they call ethnic extremism in the region.
There are also fears that what is going on in Eastern DRC now can spiral into a regional conflict, which has happened before in the not too distant past.
I think that is scaremongering as far as I can see. Which country is going to go to war in the DRC besides the protagonists that are already fighting? Burundi tried to send troops to DRC, and as we speak, there are reports that Burundi is withdrawing its troops because they have been forced to withdraw. They have prisoners of war in DRC, and M23 did warn them to remove their troops or else. I do not see Uganda going to war in the DRC, certainly not against M23. I do not see Kenya doing it. I don't think Tanzania will do it. South Africa has so far been the most aggressive of the outside actors in the DRC by sending in troops to carry out aggressive action against M23. But with the fall of Goma and the surrendering of their troops in North Kivu, I don't think that South Africa will have the stomach to engage in aggressive actions against M23. So regional conflict, I really doubt it. I think it's scaremongering, mainly by self-interested parties, humanitarian organizations that are looking to find things. I'm not sure that it's realistic.
There are suggestions that direct talks between Rwandan President Paul Kagame and Felix Tshisekedi of the DRC, perhaps with the leadership of the M23, that could help end the conflict in the eastern part of the DRC. Where do you stand on that?
That view has been floated for a very long time. And I think that of the two presidents, President Tshisekedi has been the one who has been unwilling to meet President Kagame. As you may have heard, he once even stated that he would only meet President Kagame in heaven. It's my understanding that Rwanda has been seeking dialogue. Rwanda has been insisting on M23 being negotiated with rather than being dealt with armed force. And certainly the DRC hasn't been willing to do this. And President Tshisekedi has repeated it many times. But yeah, the view among many observers and analysts is that short of negotiations, we are not going to see an end to this anytime soon.
Goloba Mutebi is a political analyst. He spoke with me from the Rwandan capital, Kigali. The Ugandan Medical Association is expressing concern about the medical condition of opposition activist Dr. Kizza Besigye. The group, which represents registered medical doctors in the East African country, is calling on the authorities to transfer Besigye to Mulago National Referral Hospital for specialized medical care and to provide a report about Besigye's health condition. It comes after members of the medical association expressed concern about the opposition leader's deteriorating health. This as critics of the administration demand Besigye's immediate release. Besigye, who is being held at Luzira Prison, recently embarked on a hunger strike to protest his ongoing trial at the military court. He began the strike after the Supreme Court ruled that it was unconstitutional for a civilian to face trial at a military court. For more about the call for medical attention for the opposition leader, I reached Dr. Herbert Luswata. He is the chairman of the Uganda Medical Association.
Yeah, Dr. Besigye was brought to court a few days ago when he looked very weak and he was in a very bad health. And there was a lot of talk that he was not receiving proper care when he was in Luzira Maximum Prison. So the doctors who started with Dr. Besigye, the colleagues he worked with, and the number of elders, we are very concerned. So they came to us as the leaders of Uganda Medical Association and requested us that we should be able to say something concerning the health of Dr. Besigye because they were worried that he could probably die from prison. Or what happened to the legislator or member of parliament, Segirinya, would possibly happen to him also. So we wrote a letter to the Commissioner General of Prisons and request him to allow our colleagues in the prison medical services to release a report concerning the health of Dr. Chiza Besigye. And this was after talking to the Commissioner of Health Services within the prisons, who informed me that he could only give me a report after the Commissioner General of Prisons had given has given him the permission to do so. But he had actually informed me that it would be very easy for him to give it to us and didn't have any problem.
But Herbert, the question that people are asking is, Dr. Besigye, as a medical doctor, decided to embark on this hunger strike himself, which he says has affected his medical condition according to his lawyers. But the question that people are asking is, why should he use this to blackmail the authorities, they argue, and to generate support from the masses by engaging in something that harms his own health, and that he is to blame for this and not the authorities, they argue.
Going on hunger strike by Dr. Chiza Besigye is because he's not convinced that his detention is actually legal. He feels he should be released and be out of prison because, according to him, he's actually innocent. That's what he's saying. He believes the trial is illegal and he's not supposed to be in prison up to this time. However, I can't say, as the president of Uganda Medical Association, whether Besigye is right to say that his detention is legal and say that the government is wrong, because I may not know the details of his case and why he was arrested and why the government is still keeping him. So our main focus as Uganda Medical Association was mainly about his health. Yes, we know the hunger strike was there, but there were talks about him having chronic medical conditions to which he was also receiving treatment from outside Uganda. And we know the level at which the health facilities in prisons are at. They are at a level of health center four. There's a lot which is lacking. So basing on his condition, the request from our members, the information from his lawyers, we were not sure if he was actually receiving a better treatment, and we thought it was right for us to ask these questions and actually request for a report.
Some people are suggesting that why wouldn't you give him the needed medical attention where he is at the moment instead of calling on the authorities to release him?
Peter, when we are giving medical treatment, referring a patient to another level of care is part of managing a patient. If you realize that at a facility where you are, you don't have the equipment or the machines required to do certain investigations, or you don't have the drugs required to treat a certain ailment, you can refer a patient to another level of care, a bigger hospital which has bigger capacity than what you have at your level of facility. So referring a patient to another level of care is part of management. And in many instances, in our hospitals, in the Mulago National Referral Hospital, regional referral hospitals, even tomorrow, if you walked into any of those hospitals, you'll find inmates in their uniforms with their cuffs tied on the beds, but they are receiving treatment from regional referral hospitals and national referral hospitals, are being guarded by the prison officers. So they refer them on a daily, other prisoners. It is not something new. It wouldn't be something special for Dr. Besigye. So we were requesting something which is not new, but which is being done even for other prisoners. So if we can manage other prisoners in a national referral hospital when they are being referred, then why not Dr. Besigye? So our request came because we didn't know that there was actually that component of saying that there is a personal physician who is seeing him and then getting him out once in a while and taking him to private clinics. We didn't have that kind of information. It just came out from the statement which was released by the president of Uganda, and that's how we know about it now.
Dr. Herbert Luswata is the chairman of the Uganda Medical Association. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala.
The chairperson of the Electoral Commission of Zambia is expressing concern that political parties are engaging in vote buying and violence. In a recent address to stakeholders in the capital Lusaka, Mwangala Zalumi also called on the Zambia Center for Interparty Dialogue, or ZCID, to lead the effort to help stop the groups from violating electoral laws. Critics, however, say the Electoral Commission should instead be engaging with law enforcement to ensure future elections are held without violence or intimidation. For analysis and the latest political development, I reached Dr. Alex Ngoma. He is a retired professor of political science at the University of Zambia.
Yes, indeed. What the chairperson of the Electoral Commission of Zambia said is actually true. There is a lot of vote buying and violence in our electoral system. But you see, what surprises me most is the fact that the culprits are always known. Now, why the Electoral Commission itself stands aloof and doesn't do anything about that is what I don't understand. You see, when the law is not enforced as it is supposed to, people take advantage. The Electoral Code of Conduct is now being violated with impunity. It is incumbent upon no one else but the Electoral Commission of Zambia chairperson to enforce the Electoral Code of Conduct. And those that are found in a breach thereof must actually be taken to book. No action is being taken. That's where the problem is. Violence, I confirm, is there. Vote buying, I confirm, is there.
So, Professor Ngoma, people are suggesting that why wouldn't the chairperson of the Electoral Commission, or ECZ, approach law enforcement agencies, including the police, to enforce the law, because it is illegal for vote buying or engage in acts of politically related violence during election period?
Yes, indeed. And the observation that many political pundits have made in this country is that when especially it is cadres from the ruling party are involved, then it becomes very difficult even for the police to touch them. Cadres from the ruling party actually commit atrocities in full view of the police, and the police is simply watching them. That is where the problem is. So law enforcement really is not at its best in this country. It's kind of selective. That is a complaint you get everywhere you go in this country at the moment.
Well, Dr. Ngoma, the suggestion from Madam Zalonis is that those political parties not engage in vote buying and or politically related violence is purely due to the lack of financial resources to engage in such acts. What do you make of this?
No, that is not correct. You see, the problem has been that when an election, especially a by-election, is taking place in a particular area, you will see people, especially members of the ruling party, beginning to ferry their cadres from one region to another. Those are the ones that go and engage in mischief. It has nothing to do with whether people have got money or not. Those that have got money actually use that money to sponsor cadres who are violent, to go and intimidate the voters so that they don't show up on election day. The point is simply to win the election by fair means or by foul. That is where the problem has been. So it's got nothing to do with money. It is a calculated political strategy on the part of those that are involved.
What do you think the Zambia Center for Interparty Dialogue, or ZCID, could help do in terms of an agreement to put an end to such a practice?
The Zambia Center for Interparty Dialogue has actually tried to bring all the stakeholders together and to discuss how best to hold peaceful, free, and fair elections. But you see, the problem is that when elections are actually taking place, everything falls apart. No one observes anything. The Zambia Center for Interparty Dialogue does not seem to have capacity actually to enforce anything. Theoretically, yes, it can bring people together and they can discuss. But when it comes to implementation of the discussions, there's no capacity by the ZCID.
Dr. Alex Ngoma is a retired professor of political science at the University of Zambia. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. In Malawi, Human Rights Defenders Coalition, a civil society group, is calling on President Lazarus Chakwera to fire all public officials who gave him misleading information contained in his recent State of the Nation address. gift trappings. The chairperson of the group says it is not acceptable for officials to give wrong information about the situation on the ground. His remarks follow the controversy surrounding the president's recent speech to the nation about development projects his administration is undertaking. Critics say the information was inaccurate. Gift Trappings, chairman of the Human Rights Defenders Coalition, tells me that any public official who misled the president must go.
For us, I think this is dangerous in terms of giving false information to the president. That is misleading. We feel that such kind of conduct is unprofessional and is uncalled for. And there's no way such kind of officer is going to be trusted. And that is why we are calling upon the president to fire those public officers who have misled him. Because otherwise, if you keep them, it means they'll be giving false information. And this is not trustworthy in terms of keeping individuals that you know cannot deliver.
But the secretary to the cabinet, Colleen Zamba, announced that ministers will now be sent to clarify the issues that had come out following the president's State of the Nation address. Why are you not pleased with this effort by the government?
I think this issue is very straightforward. If there is information that has been given that is false and has been verified, I think it's a straightforward issue. I think the president should be radical enough to remove those individuals and bring people who are professional, people who are trustworthy to work with him. Otherwise, it will just bring that impunity. What is it that they can clarify when such kind of information is already verified by some individuals in the district councils?
But Gabe, some people are suggesting that it was not a deliberate attempt to mislead the people of Malawi, and that some of these facts are just fact. If things have changed on the ground, yes, they might have changed. That is why clarification is needed, so everybody is on the same page in Malawi. Your reaction to that?
I think that's just a lame excuse. I think for me, if they were asked to give information, if these people were indeed working on the ground, they were supposed to give the president the concrete information in terms of what is on the ground. This means that those public officials are not forthcoming in terms of their work. It's just an indication that they have failed their duties. I think there's no mercy to that, and we can't develop like that if people are not giving enough information, so the president should not forgive them. I think this is a betrayal to the president, because the president is supposed to be trusted by the citizens, so they cannot keep on lying to the president and making the president lie to the citizens. I think it's not on in terms of their duties to be for them to be professional.
But the HRDC is making it clear that action must be taken. Some people are even saying a reprimand and a caution not to repeat that, but calling for their outright dismissal or firing or be forced out of office basically is overly harsh, they argue. What do you say to that?
People are employed on trust, and they're supposed to be professional. So if someone is not delivering, then why should you keep that individual? I think the issue of shielding people is over. We don't need to entertain mediocrity in terms of how we work in the public sector. So it is important for the president to send a strong warning ever is not working professionally. I think for me, firing those individuals is normal. If someone is not delivering, fire them and bring other individuals who can work professionally.
Do you expect members of parliament to raise some of these issues when the president goes to parliament to explain things he said about the State of the Nation address next week?
Even if the members of parliament raise these issues, I think Malawians have raised these issues. I think what is more important is for the citizen to raise these issues. Otherwise, our parliament is just a kangaroo parliament where they just discuss things and after that they pocket their allowances and off they go. But these issues are in the public domain and it is important for the president to address this issue.
Gift Trappens is the chairman of the Human Rights Defenders Coalition. He spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe. In Ghana, President John Dramani Mahama is calling on all his appointees to declare their assets as enshrined in the Constitution. The directive comes as he officially handed over his asset declaration form to the Auditor General Johnson Ekuamua Asiedu in the capital Accra on Tuesday. The president warned that failing to comply with the constitutional requirement may lead to the removal of public officials from office. The move, anti-corruption activists say, forms part of the effort to ensure accountability in the fight against corruption. Professor Seydou Alidu is the head of the Political Science Department at the University of Ghana, Legon. He tells me that there must be a constitutional amendment that will require more transparency in the declaration of assets by public officials.
It's a step in the right direction because if you look at most of the challenges that we have faced as a republic, it has to do with the issue of corruption and how to fight corruption. So over the years, we have a lot of laws that instructs us or gives us the direction as to how to go about fighting corruption. But most often than not, we do not respect those laws. So I don't think our challenge in fighting corruption as a country has to do with lack of legal framework for doing so. But largely, it's about obeying and respecting these legal frameworks that has been beautifully crafted over the years. And one of them has to do with the issue of asset declaration. So when people go into politics, they live huge financially than the way they came in. And when you ask them, say, oh, I was already a professional. I had done A, B, C, D before coming into public service. So I had acquired these assets before coming. So the issue of the declaration of assets is to tell the entire world and the Ghanaian citizenry at large that this is what and what and what I have acquired in my private life. And I'm coming into politics. So at the end of your service, people can now see what assets you have acquired post-politics and compared to what you had before going to politics.
With the president's initiative, yes. After he formally submitted his asset declaration form, does that set a clear message about his commitment to the fight against corruption in Ghana?
Yes, I agree that it is a strong sign of commitment that I'm the leader and I've taken the bold initiative to declare my assets and not entreat all those that have employed in the name of the Ghanaian citizenry to do the same. But here is the case. Do we know what he has declared? We don't, because the law doesn't permit them to make it public. So every other minister may follow suit and make the same declaration, but we don't know what has been declared. And we may not be able to assess what is required post-service because this has not been made public. So I agree that it's a strong commitment and it's a clear exemplary leadership. But moving forward, what we need to do is to amend the law that calls for asset declaration for whosoever officer that this is declared to make it public to the Ghanaian population so that we know that this is the number of houses Minister B has acquired, this is the number of cars, this is the number of investment before going to politics.
The president has assembled a team to review the constitution. Should transparency in asset declaration be one of the issues they should handle as part of the commitment to fight public corruption in Ghana?
I agree. And I think the president has realized, just like the other presidents who came before him, that this constitution has served the Ghanaian public for over 32 years. There were a lot of things that we never envisaged when this constitution was being drafted. And we have faced the realities of government, the challenges of the external and internal environment to the governance processes. And we have realized that some of the provisions need to be amended. And I applaud him for actually reigniting the process and to make sure that this is done. And now, and I think one of the key things that we have to look at is the fact that the asset declaration law should be allowed for the asset declared, so declared by political leaders to be made public so that we all know. People say, oh no, you are exposing them. You are exposing them to thieves and people know that this particular building belongs to this particular person and that makes them vulnerable. I agree, but if nobody knows what is being declared, how then do we hold you to account after you have finished your service? So I will encourage that as part of the constitutional review processes that President Mahama has instituted, these are some of the key things that should be looked at. We need to amend them so that the declaration could be public, and then we know what is acquired post-public service compared to what you came into public service with.
I was going to ask you about calling on his appointees to do the same. Failure to do that, they could even be removed from office. What does this message send, in your view?
I think it's a bold leadership, an example leadership. I agree that in the past, people will declare, the leadership will declare and call his appointees to do so, and they may not. So if you look at the manner in which this directive is worded, I believe that he is in to protect his legacy, and he's in to advance the collective interest and the welfare and the well-being of Ghanaians. And one of the best ways to do that is to close the public purse and to make sure that whatever is so generated is invested in the country. So I think it is good. And any appointee that doesn't heed this call, I think he should dismiss that person so that people will know that he's serious about it, and every other appointee will follow suit. So I think he should be very bold. He should make sure that people or ministers or appointees who refuse to heed this call should be sent packing. And then people know that he's very serious, and this is a different kind of leadership.
Professor Seydou Alidou is the head of the Political Science Department at the University of Ghana, Lagos. He spoke with me from the capital, Accra. Philip Agbese, a member of the Nigerian House of Representatives, has announced plans to file a defamation lawsuit against the chief of compliance officer at the cryptocurrency company Binance over allegations of corruption. It comes after Tigran Gambaryan, the Binance chief compliance officer, wrote on his ex social media account alleging that Agbese and two other Nigerian lawmakers had demanded $150 million bribe from him during the 2024 meeting. The lawsuit comes after coverage of the allegations by Nigerian news outlets such as Channels Television and Blueprint. Samuel Ihezekian is the lawyer for Philip Agbese. He tells me that the lawmaker also will file a defamation lawsuit in the United States to seek redress for the injury to his reputation caused by the allegation.
The defamation case made by the chief compliance and financial officer, purportedly Mr. Tigran Gambaryan, who has before now in a Wired article and the New York Times, has made some damning allegations against some Nigeria top officials in the person of the NSA, Nuhu Ribadu, and three members of the House of Rep, most especially the one that relates to me, the one who has briefed me to handle his matter, in the person of Right Honorable Philip Agbese, who happens to represent the good people of Okadigbo and Ado and one other local government in the Nigerian House of Representatives, otherwise known as the Nigerian Parliament. In the U.S. term, he's also known as the congressman. So he has briefed me over the issue. Before now, we all know all over the world that Mr. Tigran Gambaryan has made serious damning allegations that suffices and borders on corruption allegations. He actually alleged that $150 million as bribe money was solicited from him by the three congressmen and some unknown top Nigerian officials. We find that very insulting, and we find that as a collective insult to our personality, first, as Nigerians. Second, that Nigerians are actually hardworking people.
Some are suggesting, yes, that this suit against this top executive of this financial institution is a way of silencing him from free speech as enshrined in the Nigerian Constitution.
No, it's this is defamation, can come in the form of online defamation, can come as a way of libel, can come as a way of slander. But this one, when Mr. Tigran Gambaryan made this allegation, when you say corruption allegation, when you say fraudulent allegation, there must be proof, substantiated proof and corroborated evidence. There is none at all. It's just in his narrative. He said this is the factual narrative. Factual narrative. That means he's explaining a scenario without substance. He has no recording. He has no proof as to when this money has been sought for by these government officials. He has no record. He has no record of any kind. He has no official correspondence. He has nothing to show that this money was being sought for by these government officials. So how can you, in the proper sense, prove financial or bribery allegations against this person?
Some of his supporters are saying that if somebody comes to solicit you for bribe and you refuse,
yes,
and you say that, yes, this approach was made, of course, there was nothing in writing form. So then you can claim deniability, although such an act has happened. They said this happens all the time.
You know, Mr. Peter Clotty, you know my personality. I've been a staunch and a very active member of the Nigerian civil society. I'm also being, you should trust my pedigree on this matter. I have done my discreet investigation on my honor. I can tell you that the allegations against those respected members of Nigeria Parliament, it is bogus. There is nothing, it is not a political move. It is basically when someone make an allegation against you that have no substance, that have no bearing, that have no justification, in the proper sense, it is defamation. And the only way you could clear your name is to approach the law court wherever you hear such wild allegations. And that is what Philip Agbese has done. And that is what Ginger Owusibi, the other one who went earlier to the court. More importantly, we should also know that Mr. Tigran Gbaya was in Nigeria. He never made this allegation. We only heard of Binance, what I said, who said some unknown officers. Mr. Tigran had to safely, when he has returned back to America, in the comfort and the safety of his home, before he started giving this narrative.
When will the court begin hearing about this suit?
As soon as possible. When it is assigned, he has lawyers. He has lawyers who are representing him here. We tend to seek the leave of the court to serve those lawyers. And when that is done, we'll do that. But we are not just ruling out, just sue him here in our local court. We are also thinking of approaching the American court, where he will be put to test to the statements and defamatory allegations he has made against, more particularly, Philip Agbese.
Samuel Ihezekian is the lawyer for Philip Agbese, a member of the Nigerian House of Representatives. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. The Nigerian government says it wants to raise its profile as a hub for agricultural export in 2025 through what it's calling the Earn from the Soil Initiative. The program is also an attempt to reduce the nation's dependence on oil revenue. For VOA, Emeka Gibson has the report from the Nigerian capital, Abuja, narrated by Anthony Labruto.
Moses Diogo, a 59-year-old retired civil servant, has been farming for nearly 30 years. On his 10-hectare farm, he grows rice, beans, and peanuts. He hopes to expand production under the Earn from the Soil initiative. Diogo says with an equivalent of $2,000, he believes he could significantly increase his production.
If I'm able to get 3 million naira, it will help me more. Because last year I planted about 2 hectares of groundnut. But this time around, I said by the grace of God, at least between 4 or 5.
Funded by the Central Bank of Nigeria, the initiative has allocated over $32 million for low-interest loans to smallholder farmers, tax incentives, and plans to create more export zones for global market access. It is focusing on expanding subsistence farming into larger-scale agricultural operations focused on high-value crops like cocoa, sesame, cashew nuts, and ginger for export. Diogo says while this is a good initiative for farmers, he's yet to access government grants or credit support.
I have tried in such a way that at least the procedure, how to get this support, but I tried. All of these proved abortive. But at times when this thing comes, it is difficult for some of us to meet up with the procedure, to know a person, to this and that. Even though it comes, there are some selected ones that normally would not help.
Agriculture contributed about 22.6% to Nigeria's overall GDP and made up about 5.4% of its total exports in the second quarter of 2024, according to the National Bureau of Statistics. Abuja-based agribusiness consultant Bridget Okpokoro says there's room for growth, but infrastructure issues need to be addressed.
So we need to increase our capacity of production We are not able to do that yet because the smallholder farmers are not empowered enough to be able to take on this challenge. Another reason why we cannot export is that we're not meeting the standards of exporting outside the country.
Okpokoro says targeted policies and training to empower smallholder farmers and align with Nigeria's export goals.
If government can come in, or other stakeholders can come in and create policies, for example, tax reduction, tax incentives, policies that will make it easy for the farmers who are ready to export.
For Nigeria to meet its 2025 goal of becoming a leading agricultural exporter, experts say it must turn ambition into action by educating and equipping smallholder farmers with modern tools and supportive policies. For Gibson Emeka in Abuja, Nigeria, Anthony Libruto, VOA News.
South Sudan is facing a severe economic crisis driven by Sudan's war, climate change, and rising unemployment. Many residents of the capital, Juba, are struggling to meet their family's basic needs. Some women trying to feed their families are venturing into quarry business, traditionally a male-dominated job. For VOA News, Ibasi Patricia Tubbs reports from Juba.
Mary Diko Kumoi, Nancy Izawa, and Mary Ayete begin working from their homes to Hayat Company up the hill near Lokulili residential area in Juba 6 days a week every early morning. The three women crash stones to earn a living in a harsh economic environment in South Sudan's capital, Juba. 49-year-old Mary Diko Kumoi is a widow who lost her husband in 2018. She says since she does not have a formal education, she has turned to crushing stones to support her family of eight who depend on her for food and school fees. Kumoi says she worries about the fate of the quarry business after they were told to leave the place that is scheduled for settlement demarcation.
It's a family situation that brought me here. I've been breaking stones for 10 years. If the hardship continues, feeding my family and paying for my children's school fees is difficult, and there's no solution. Now in Shirka Hayat, they plan to start demarcation, which means we will lose our place for breaking stones. We are suffering as widows, where we lose of us without husbands go if this place is demarcated. This is where we survive.
42-year-old Nancy Izawa is another mother who has been crushing stones for a living since 2017. She says she uses her earnings from the stone business to support the six children of her younger brother. She adds that she too worries about the fate of her only source of income.
I started crushing the stones. At one time, I vomited blood. I treated myself and still continue to work because I don't have any other job. This work is tedious. Sometimes I work, then my legs swell and my chest pains. But now this hired company, it is now being given as plots to people. Now how shall we survive?
38-year-old Mary Ayete, a mother of four children, says the quarry business has been her only source of income since 2009.
I am raising children on my own, so I decided to come to the mountain to break stones. I am tired, but with the current economic situation, I need to pay for the children's school fees and provide food. Everything is on me, and I can't afford it as a mother.
The women say they earn about 100,000 South Sudanese pounds per week, but worry their business may end soon, creating additional stress on their families. For VOA News, I am Ibasi Patricia Tubbs reporting from Juba.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, right now it's time for music from our African collection.
shoto akini pige dicho ni midundu ya moyo. I say oops, but I thought I told you about that. Anything you need, I got you, I got you. Told you that baby, I got you. For my life, it's deeper than TV, I got you, I got you. So when I call me back, do not wonder. I said I promise that when I call, do not wonder. Way back way, you know that I don't play. Streets not safe, but I never run away. Even when I'm away, OT, OT, there's never much love when we go OT. I pray to make it back in one piece. I pray, that's why I need a one dance. Got a Hennessy in my hand, one more time before I go. Higher powers taking a hold on me. I need a one dance, got a Hennessy in my hand. One more time before I go, higher powers taking a hold on me.
Baby, I like your style.
Strength and guidance, all that I'm wishing for my friends. Nobody makes it from my ends. I had to bust up the silence. You know you gotta stick by me. Soon as you see the text, reply me. I don't wanna spend time fighting. We got no time, and that's why I need a one dance. Got a Hennessy in my hand. One more time before I go. Higher powers taking a hold on me. I need a one dance. Got a Hennessy in my hand. One more time before I go. Higher powers taking a hold on me.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. From the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Mogbil Yabaru, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, when your brother is a thief, you do not pursue a thief in the dark with a machete. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.
I need a one dance, got a Hennessy in my hand. One more time before I go, higher powers taking a hold on me. I need a one dance, got a Hennessy in my hand. One more time before I go, higher powers taking a hold on me.